better way.
And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3512 of the Survival Podcast. If you're tracking, this is a Bitcoin Breakout podcast only. This will be episode 52 of the Bitcoin Breakout. We're going to talk about something today. We're going to talk about Bitcoin in general, but we're going to leave off like the first half of the show. Instead of answering, I have a ton of Bitcoin questions that have been coming in. We're going to lead off, though, with just an epiphany that I had. Looking forward, I decided I was going to do this show, this episode of the show. I think it was either Saturday or Sunday morning. And I was chatting with people on social media, specifically Noster. And somehow it came to me that, like, really, no matter what happens at this point, Bitcoin is going to do really well for us long term. And the way I put it is, if the dollar collapses, then Bitcoin does well. And if they inflate their way out of it, which is the goal, right? Like, people think that inflation bad. Well, it is bad for us, but it's their tool that they use to inflate away their debt. And in doing so, they often help to inflate away our debt. If you hold a, especially long-term debt, inflation can work to your advantage in some areas, like the fact that I pay less for a 2,500 square foot house with 3 acres of land, including taxes and insurance, than most people are paying for 2-bedroom apartments now. Because I bought the house over 10 years ago, and that's how inflation works when you have debt. So there's some people that actually really like inflation. Now, those people don't really understand how many other ways inflation sucks value from them. They're focused on one thing, like debt for housing. Okay, but if they do inflate the debt away, if we go back to normal, well, it's good for Bitcoin. If they can inflate the debt away, well, it's good for Bitcoin. We're going to go through a whole bunch of scenarios like that, and that's where this idea came from. Where I want to start out, though, as always, let's take care of our sponsors real quick. They help pay the bills around here. Sponsor day number one today is Start 9 Embassy Servers. Check these guys out, man. With a little bitty box, you know, something you can easily hold in one hand, you can change your life and take back your digital sovereignty. You can run a Bitcoin node. You can run your own Lightning node if you want to. But there's a lot of other things that Start9 does beyond just run Bitcoin stuff. Because I think some people are like, I already run a node. I really don't need to do that. I don't need a Lightning node, what have you. And, you know, most people don't need their own Lightning node. But how about end-to-end encrypted texting that can't be broken? And you also really can't be monitored, because the only people that can get in on the sessions are people that you allow to set up and approve an account for, because you're running your own platform instead of using somebody else's. How about storing your data and being able to access your data anywhere in the world across Tor in a completely encrypted and secure and anonymous manner, no matter where you go, without using McCloud? All of these things, and they might sound technical. I'll tell you, if you want to see somebody laugh, tell Tom, my web guy, Jack's really technical. He'll laugh pretty hard. I've been thinking about, you know, what's the right meme template for that little joke right there? This isn't hard, guys. If you can use a smartphone, you can install and use apps, then you can use a Start9 Embassy server. And MSB members, do not forget, you get a discount of 9%. And on, you know, Start9, something you have to buy once, cry once, but it is pretty expensive. That 9% will cover your membership fees easily for over a year. Next up today, K9 Academy, Joel Riles. Our dog, Belle, is a Fortress Canine, is one of his pups. And I bartered for her. Actually, my wife bartered for her at a drunken barter blanket one night. And Joel got me for a week here at my place for consulting. And I helped him develop the program that you're looking at right here. And it really is the best online dog training course you can take. And, you know, it's really not a dog training course. It's a person training course. So that you can train yourself so that you can train your dog. Because dogs are easy. Humans are the more difficult one to fix, because we anamorphize. We don't want to do this because it's, you know, want to let the dog be a dog type of thing. And really, you know, the discipline that you instill in your dog makes everybody's life better, including your dog's. Definitely check out K9Academy.com. With that, let's get into this. And again, the way that this whole thing came up was this weekend thinking about, like, well, what would have to go wrong in the world right now for Bitcoin to die, or for Bitcoin to not work, for Bitcoin to really represent a risk? And as you noticed, maybe the title of this is Bitcoin is a zero risk move. I would have told you that 10 years ago. I don't know that I would have told you it 5 years ago. And I'm not saying that right now there is no way to end up with risk in Bitcoin. You could lose your keys if you do improper procedures and things like that. And the other thing is, and I just answered a question on Thursday last week about this, Bitcoin is volatile. And that is a feature, not a bug. If it wasn't volatile, you wouldn't be interested in it. Now, you just wouldn't, because the volatility is what makes the long-term value there as getting in as an early investor. And a lot of people think that, well, we're 15 years, we're, you know, early is over. Early is not over. Honestly, if you look at it logarithmically, the adoption of Bitcoin and the adoption of the internet year for year are almost identical in total number of users. So, you know, how old is the internet now? And how big a deal is the internet now? So I think we're on that same path. But there were a lot of things that could have went wrong. And one of the reasons I was such a proponent of the ETF is because of what it means. What it means is you have police officers, firefighters, and school teachers who now have Bitcoin in their pension funds. And we're just past the days of they're going to ban it and going to go to zero. That's just over. It's not even worth the discussion anymore. I won't even have the discussion anymore. I've been hearing this bullshit since 2013. So that's 11 years of listening to it. I'm done. Today I'm covering questions, but I'm not covering questions like, what if they outlaw it? What if they turn off the internet? Like, I'm not doing this anymore. I've said this before. I'm not being a dick. I'm just done with those questions. I've been doing it for over a decade. I'm done. If you don't think it's worth investing in, don't spend your money on it. It will not affect me at all. I won't care. I won't know. It's not important to me that you buy Bitcoin. It's important to me that you make an informed decision in your life and go whichever way you want. That's it. That's why I do what I do. The time to argue about Bitcoin being banned or going to zero is over. It's done. The time to discuss the block size wars and Bitcoin cash, which I call Bitcoin trash, and Roger Ver's book and all the bullshit trying to resurrect a war they fought and lost, what, 5 years ago, 6, 7 years ago, something like that. 2017, 2018 was a cycle, right? So six, seven years. It's over. You fought a war, you lost. I'm done. I'm not having that discussion anymore. The time to talk about why shitcoin XYZ is going to be the next Bitcoin, done, right? If you want to go, you want to go play in that world, you go ahead. It's over. It's done. It's over. Like, all of this is past now. We're in a different world. And in this world, let's just examine certain financial scenarios going forward and what does Bitcoin look like in those scenarios. One would be the dollar fully loses global reserve status, which we're well on the way to happening. I actually think this is a highly probable thing. There's always some sort of Hail Mary pass that can forestall it for another few decades, though. You just don't know. But Saudis just failed to renew our agreement for the petrodollar. That's pretty much... without the petrodollar, you really don't have global reserve status anymore. We are now at what I guess you would call a default, and I don't mean the bad default, like, you know, when you can't pay your bills, but a default reserve status. And what I mean by that is it's still the most used currency in the world for global trade, completely by choice. But what got that in position in the first place is there isn't a nation on the planet that doesn't use oil, that doesn't buy or sell oil. And many nations buy and sell oil, right? They produce oil and they also import oil, even though they produce more than they need because there's different grades of crude and various agreements the governments have to do certain things to stabilize markets, et cetera. And so once the Saudis got on board with the petrodollar, then OPEC is on board with them. And pretty much you end up in a situation where oil, if you're going to have oil as part of your economy, which good luck without it, despite what the Stop Oil activist idiots say, you don't have an economy without oil in 2024, right? You didn't have one in 1971, I think, is when this was originally, or 73, when this agreement was entered into. You didn't have an economy then without oil. That's why they did it, especially after we closed the gold window temporarily, and then we realized, well, that temporary is about as temporary as anything government does, which will be permanent. So we need something to lock it in since we don't have the gold component to it anymore. And now that's gone. You have the rise of the BRIC nations beginning to trade with each other and building that coalition. You know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa is now like another 12 nations have officially joined the alliance. And there's a shitload of them who are like kind of like plebs right now waiting to get into the fraternity type of thing. Like they've applied to do that. And so if we do lose global reserve status, what that's going to do is cause a shitload of U.S. dollars to be what's called repatriated. That means they basically get dumped back to the United States. So that's going to cause huge amounts of inflation. And the only thing that the Federal Reserve can do is contract the supply to try to fight that. So if that happens, the upside for Bitcoin is huge. It doesn't take a genius to figure out major inflation for the dollar, major trouble for the dollar equals a more powerful Bitcoin. Right? I mean, you have to figure that out. Charlie Cooper says, are we fucked? Spherical. I think we're fucked, but that's all, you know, it's all relative to exactly what that looks like, right? Maybe it'll be more clear as we go. But let's say the U.S. dollar doesn't necessarily lose reserve status, but this cancerous inflation that we're having, and to be fair to Brandon's administration, this year of inflation has not been as bad as typical, but I don't think we should measure inflation by the year. We should look at inflation in any given snapshot over at least a 4 to 6 year cumulative number. And we should also throw out the number they give us and look at real inflation that includes the real cost of food, the real cost of energy, and the real cost of housing, not the backhanded bullshit that they pull with CPI, which is the consumer price index. It should be called CPLI. It's the consumer price lie. Because you don't have to be a genius to know that it costs more to live today than it did last year. Okay, but if we just stick with a cancerous type of inflation, something akin to what we've seen over the last 5 years, well, that's good for Bitcoin. Bitcoin will continue to grow in value as the dollar shrinks in value. Very, very simple. And on the other side of it, we're looking at, of course, that limited supply. And as there's more and more call for it, more and more investment demand, that pushes it up versus the dollar. So both of the things that are bad for the dollar are good for Bitcoin. Well, let's flip that all the way around. Let's say that the Fed gets the money printer to go burr at just the right frequency of burr. They get it just right. We have some more, couple more years of pain. Orange band comes back. Bah, 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 bah. The band strikes back up. Everybody's happy. China starts building factories in South Texas again because import tariffs or whatever bullshit happens. And we go back to something that looks like the Fed's goal, which is a 2% inflation per year, which will really be a 4% because it's at least double whatever they say it is. That's like a basic rule that you can follow. If they say it's 4, it's 8. If they say it's 8, it's 16. In the real cost in your life, because as they're doing their shit to rein in inflation, they're increasing the cost of money. And what really matters to you isn't that the pickup truck you want to buy is $30,000. What really matters to you, unless you have $30,000 cash to whip out, is what? The payment for 5 years or 6 years or 7 years. We now have people that feel like, well, I'm doing okay because I have a car payment that's pretty much the same car payment that I've always had. But now instead of a 48-month financing on a vehicle, they're doing a 60. They're doing 72 months on a vehicle. You know, I was just offered that by Toyota on our leased vehicle. If we buy it from them, they offered me 72-month terms on a vehicle that will be 3 years old when the lease is up with a ridiculous interest rate. Wasn't even a bad price for the truck. But the cost is higher, right? So when we end up in that situation, that is good for Bitcoin. But what if they do kind of dial it in? They get that frequency of burr just right. And things go back to normal, right? The way they were 6 years ago when people felt like I can get ahead. There's a way to do this now. Well, that's the environment Bitcoin existed in for most of its first part of existence. Other than right when it was released and we were in the middle of the financial crisis of 2008-09, but no one, like, it wasn't really a thing yet. By the time Bitcoin was on exchanges, you could buy it. The average person could get their hands on it, figure out how to work it. We weren't mining it with laptops anymore. By the time we got there, we were in a pretty basic, normal economy. It was still in recovery, but so it worked then. So if they fix everything, sort of, sweep shit under the rug, Bitcoin will do fantastic. So, like, in all the scenarios, just looking at the dollar alone, no matter what happens, it's good for Bitcoin. If real estate returns to normal, it's good for Bitcoin. A good functioning economy where people have houses and are buying stuff and exchanging goods and services and things are basically okay, it's great for Bitcoin. What if real estate collapses? It damn well might. You know the only thing keeping real estate from collapsing right now? Honestly, illegal immigration. Follow it. Just follow it out to its logical conclusion. Yeah, I know they have a lot of illegal aliens that are living in nice hotels in New York City and shit like that, but it's somewhere north of 11 million people. 11 million people. Where are they going to live? See, this is something that the open borders people never really think about. But yet a Star Trek author, Ken, I'm reading a Star Trek series right now based on the series Picard, the one they made a three season movies out of, or three season limited series on. And in that Star Trek universe, the Romulan sun explodes and the Romulans end up like interstellar refugees. And they're asking this person that governs a planet that's taken some of them in, it takes some more in. And the Federation's like, hey, look, you got lots of space. You got lots of room. It's not like there's not enough room for these people. And the person running the governor of the planet says, yeah, that's not how it works. They need housing and they need food and they need a place to live and they need infrastructure. Like, you can't just dump people in the middle of the field. Valid point, right? But our people in government, our people are warped-ass young generation, their warped-ass minds can't see that if you bring 11 million people into a country where there's already a shortage of available housing, you make it worse. How about energy, right? Electricity demands. What happens when you add 11 million people to a country and you haven't built any more power generation or any new infrastructure in any meaningful level? You got problems. So if housing actually does collapse, still good for Bitcoin. In fact, it's great for Bitcoin because then you have a lot of people who have traditionally seen a safe place for their money to be being real estate that don't study history, haven't seen how many times people have been completely wiped out in the real estate market, start to realize what Michael Saylor teaches, right? Bitcoin is the superior property to own and to put your surplus capital into. Its returns exceed real estate over time. And additionally, there's no cost to maintain it. There's no tenants to kick out. Nobody tears up. My niece is right now was asking me some questions about a house she still owns that I didn't know she still owned from when she lived in Arkansas near us. She's owned it for 10 years. She's renting it to somebody. It makes a little bit of money, the underlying equities, but they're screwing the house up. And she's too far away to really be a good landlord and stay on top of it. I'm like, well, you got to charge more money. You got to get them back on it because they don't even have a lease right now. You got to get them out and sell the place or sell it and let somebody else deal with throwing them out. But that's all a problem, right? If you had Bitcoin for the last 10 years, then you would be a hell of a lot better off than holding that property, even if there wasn't a tenant in it. So real estate recovers, good for Bitcoin. Real estate collapses, good for Bitcoin. What about when we look at the global world and all this war and shit that's going on? Well, Bitcoin hasn't given two shits about the world at war. If the United States enters another war, well, we were in Afghanistan and Iraq for the majority of the time Bitcoin's been around. Bitcoin didn't care. But what if we actually somehow return to a level of peace, relative peace, like the peace that we briefly had when Biden made a terrible withdrawal from Afghanistan, but at least we got out. Or the peace that existed, tenuous, but it was a peace, between the first and second Gulf War. We were at relative peace other than the shit that went on in the Balkans. or that even though it was a Cold War, we were at a tenuous relative peace through most of the 1980s. And honestly, the second half of the 70s, once we were smart enough to get out of Vietnam, well, it's good for Bitcoin. If we enter another war, again, Bitcoin won't care. This is what I said on Noster. Somebody's asking if I'm streaming on Noster. I have no idea how to stream on Noster. If there's a way to use RMTP to stream on Noster, somebody please tell me and I'll start doing it in the next episode. But as far as I know, that doesn't exist just yet. So somebody should be coding that shit. I'm just saying. The only way Bitcoin really stops working and becomes a risk asset, you got other problems. If we start tossing nuclear missiles at each other, intercontinental ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads, and we irradiate the planet, yeah, that'll probably fuck the Bitcoin world up pretty good. Pretty good. It may, in fact, end up being the currency of choice in the rebuilding if there's anything left to rebuild. If it's not, you know, the day after level war, if it's some limited nuclear exchange. But, no, there is nothing short of something to that level. And again, I'm not here to argue with people today that hate Bitcoin. If you hate Bitcoin, don't attend Bitcoin breakouts. That's why I specifically do them as Bitcoin breakouts, so that the large portion of my audience that doesn't want anything to do with it knows it's a Bitcoin show and you don't have to show up. I'm done hand-holding. There isn't anything left. They're not going to turn the internet off. If they turn the internet off, they destroy their own systems of control and manipulation. They're not going to turn all the electricity off, right? Like, this whole idea is preposterous. It's about the only thing that can happen is some form of, like, an Ellie. An Ellie is an extinction-level event. A comet hitting the planet. Like, something like that has to happen to derail this at this point. And again, I want to point out, when I say no risk, you know, there's a zero-risk move in putting surplus capital into Bitcoin right now. That has to do with your timeline. If I just answered, like I said, last week, I answered a question. Person's going to have a big windfall profit from the sale of some real estate, about $600,000. And they're going to rent for a year to make sure the place they think they want to move to is really the place they want to move to. That's not a bad play. And then they're going to buy a house. And they said, how much of this money should we put into Bitcoin? I said, not one penny beyond what you think you're going to need to buy the next house with. Because the risk is in the volatility and having the capital tied into the asset and needing the capital when you're in a down part of the cycle. That's the risk right now. Other than that, there is nothing that is going to derail this. Again, you can't say that this government ban shit, forget about it. The fake Indian that beats on her tom-tom and makes noise about crypto, forget about it, right? The Democrats are going to, the Democrats are going to ban it. They controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House for 2 years. They didn't do shit, right? You notice they always talk about things they're not going to do when they have a way to say they can't do it yet. They talk the most about things that they're going to do when they know they can't actually get it done, because that way they can look like they're doing something without actually doing something. They're really good at that. So I do want to get some questions answered here that have come in over email since the last time we did a breakout. If you have a question for me that's not, what about my shit coin, or it's going to go to zero or something like that, please put the word question in all caps in the live chat, and I will try to make sure that those get answered during the stream as well. That's about my only requirement there. And that you ask me the question in a single sentence. And if you want to give me details, follow up with details. So one of the questions I get a lot, actually, and I've talked about it before, how would the Bitcoin standard, if we had a Bitcoin standard, affect lending or borrowing against Bitcoin? So let's start off with the borrowing against Bitcoin component. And that comes, of course, from Michael Saylor. Michael Saylor is really the first person that talked about borrowing against Bitcoin, not for short-term purchases. So the Bitcoin loans that we have right now are kind of shitty, and they really only work well for like what's called a bridge loan. In other words, I will have the capital in the short term, but I need it now, and I don't have it now, and I don't want to sell my Bitcoin. So I'm going to take a loan against it and repay it as quickly as possible, so the cost of the service of the loan is less than the cost that I'll miss by not being in the market if Bitcoin goes up. And if nothing else, I'm not going to pay the capital gains that I would pay if I sold my Bitcoin at a profit. That is not the kind of loans that he's talking about. What he's talking about are loans that, again, these do not exist yet, but I believe and he believes that they will exist, because as a bank, I would have to be an idiot to not want to loan money with a pristine 100% backed capital. And so in that instance, you do need a currency, right, a fiat-type currency, for that plan to work. So the question that came in was really, well, what if we do, like, the world adopts Bitcoin as money, and Bitcoin becomes the money? Yeah, that strategy wouldn't work anymore. You have to have an inflationary currency to borrow against the deflationary asset. Right, that's how that formula works. And I've run the numbers, and being very, very conservative, if you were sitting on, $4 million worth of Bitcoin 10 years from now, and you were about 60 years of age, with very small percentile loans, you could live the rest of your predictable life and never run out of money. And basically, the next loan finances the last debt. And it just works, even with a very, very conservative approach to the continual average rate that Bitcoin continues to appreciate by, with it very, very, very conservative. But those loans don't exist yet, and they would not work in that situation where you didn't have a competitive currency that's inferior. That's why it works. It's why it works with real estate. And that's something people need to understand. All Saylor's talking about doing is what rich people have used real estate for forever, to avoid taxes. Like, long before anybody watching the stream was born, rich people were doing this. You get a building in Manhattan, you lease it out as office space, and then you turn around and borrow against it. And it goes up in value, and you refinance it, and you borrow against it again. You do it until you wear it out, you sell it, you harvest the equity, you roll it into the next property, and you do it again. And you build up a big portfolio of real estate, and you're always borrowing from different properties at different times and letting the appreciation take care of the debt, which is the inflation of the money. At the same time, the property is appreciating in overall value. So you got to have something to play against to make that work. But the other part of that question, I don't even know if that's really what the gentleman was asking, but it's actually a really interesting question. If we did go to a standard, like a Bitcoin standard, where the money that you have today, let's say 5 years from now, will be worth more than it is today, it will be harder to earn the same amount of money. Right now, it's easier to earn the same amount of money you could have earned in 2015. I mean, does that make sense? Like, right now, if you go down to Walmart or Chick-fil-A and you ask for a job, do you know what they're paying here? And this is not like a super high dollar area, $14 to $18 an hour between those types of jobs. And I don't mean to be a shift manager. I don't mean to be a store manager. No, those people are making middle to upper 20s per hour plus incentive comp. There's a kid that I read an article on. He's managing some kind of chain. It's like a Chick-fil-A. It's not a Chick-fil-A. It's like a Chicken Express, but it's another brand. This kid's like 19 years old. He's making $65,000 a year managing a store, right? So it's easier to make the same amount of money. It's easier to raise $5,000 in cash today than it was in 2015. But it buys less, yeah? What if you borrowed $5,000 in 2015 and you had to pay it back while it was going on? It's actually pretty easy to pay back, and it's also easy to justify an interest rate from the lender. The lender is going to get more back than they put in. Okay, but what if the money became worth more over time? What if $5,000 was harder to earn in 2024 than it was in 2015? You see the trap there. And then you add interest. And if I don't get interest as a lender, what is my incentive to lend money? And it's honestly a situation that we haven't been in any living memory. And even prior to leaving the gold standard, if we go back to even prior to the Federal Reserve, where they could fuck around and pretend there was the gold. Even then, we didn't have the kind of scenario that you'd be entering if this happened in a short period of time. As global adoption accelerated, the value of Bitcoin would get astronomically more powerful. What does a salary look like that environment? Let's say that my annual salary that I offer you, right, to work for me right now is one Bitcoin a year, $60,000 a year. Okay, as your employer, I can't actually give you raises when Bitcoin goes to $150,000. I can't even make, like, you see what I'm saying? You see how that would be hard? Like, if I'm Mike, Tennessee Permaculture's here, if I hired Mike for one Bitcoin per year or 1.5 Bitcoin per year, depending on what he was doing, over time, I actually have to cut his pay in total Satoshis down to keep his salary commensurate with the value he's providing me and the value that I'm putting out to my customer. As money becomes more scarce, there's less units, not more, available. Same number of units are out there, but the available units go down. And this is why I actually, all this talk of a Bitcoin standard, I see a Bitcoin standard differently than everybody and their mothers using Bitcoin. Every government's using Bitcoin. I think if governments adopt Bitcoin, they will do it in a hybrid model where they will say there's some portion of Bitcoin that backs the currency because it's on the balance sheet of the central bank. But it won't be full all out. One, because of what I just said, our economy is not designed to work that way. The transition to that would be muddy and ugly and take a lot of time. They would have to make a decision. We're going to do this over like 20 years to figure everything out. Just accounting practices alone wouldn't work. And then the other side is they give up too much power. I don't see the banks ever giving up complete control or some control of the ability to expand and contract the monetary supply. And I don't see people ever really getting smart enough in my lifetime anyway to figure out why they do it. So I don't see it going away anyway. But it would be an interesting, like, how would you handle, let's say I needed one Bitcoin to buy a house. Bitcoin was worth $300,000 somewhere in the future, and we go to a Bitcoin standard. Now I got to pay one Bitcoin back. But it gets harder and harder to earn, you know, 1,000 Satoshis or 100,000 Satoshis to make my Bitcoin payment to the bank. You see how that works. Deflation has its own issues when we're talking about monetary supply contraction. And it's not, again, it's not really contraction. It's lack of units that exist. It all works except lending. Lending is going to be an interesting thing to see. Somebody, K-Vonk says there's a rumor that the Fed got hacked and their website is down. That'd be kind of funny if it's true. Couldn't happen to a bunch of nicer people, right? And you know, they kind of deserve it if it happens because, well, they're the Fed and they should not be easy to hack. Come on, guys. You guys literally print the money. You have all the money. You can't afford a good network? What, really? All right, moving on. I had another interesting question. He said, can you tell me what you think holding Bitcoin will do for your standard of living? Will it improve it or just preserve it? Because if you save and your savings beats inflation just a little bit, basically all you do is stay where you're at. You have to have this continued upward movement for it to improve your standard of living. And he said, you know, what's that look like over 5, 10, and 20 years? And the answer is, I don't know. My belief is it will definitely increase your standard of living when you decide to make the shift and start in some manner pulling from your reserves for your retirement. Yes. A person that stacks enough sufficiently for long enough may enter a cycle where they're in young retirement. They don't even care about the taxes. They're not going to borrow, and they just have enough money to live on from it. And I would say that if my income is, let's say, $100,000 a year, and let's not worry about that number. Let's say, just imagine what the life of a person making $100,000 a year is like, you know, not in stupid places like San Francisco or Los Angeles that are super expensive, middle America. And if I can now completely replace my income, so I'm getting the same money, but I don't have to work for it, has my standard of living gone up? I would say yes. And that means any work that I do, any income that I have is by choice rather than need. I think it over any significant period of time is going to improve your standard of living. I think that if your time horizon right now is less than 10 years, you're not in the right mental state for this type of investing. I'm not saying you might not do really, really well to throw a bunch of money in right now and wait a year and a half. We might have a huge, I think the run up in this cycle of this market, you know, it's not really due until like we get toward the end of this year that we have the real run up. I think everybody got excited pre-halving when we had that run up, you know, we hit an all-time high. That was unusual. It doesn't track historically the way that things usually happen after the halving. It's usually go into that Q4 of that year of the halving, and that's when you have everything really explode and then continue on in that early part of the next year. And I don't expect that to be any different this time. But you should be thinking in the 10-year mindset. And just go back 10 years. Just go back and look up what Bitcoin was selling for in 2014. And tell me there's any way that if you bought as much as you could have in 2014, sitting here today, that you lost. And the truth is there's not another asset on the planet that performed as well over that 10-year period. Nothing has. Even Peter Schiff has conceded that. So I think it will improve your standard of living. And that's a big part of why I do it. It's not the only reason. It's a big part. Another gentleman emailed me, said, what if you have a 401k with your employer and they're doing an employer match? Should you say the hell with the match and take the money that would go into your 401k and instead buy and stack Bitcoin with it? Probably. In this guy's situation, almost definitely. His employer match is 6%. So now, I don't know what that really meant because the way he phrased it, it wasn't clear. So there's two ways you could mean that. I put in a dollar, the employer puts in 6 cents. That's how it read. But as I'm saying it, there are employers that are like, they do like dollar for dollar match up to 6%. So that means 6% of your income goes in. And if you put in $200 this month, it immediately turns into $400. It's doubled. If that's the situation you're in, it makes actually a lot of sense inside 401s because I believe eventually you're going to be able to buy Bitcoin in every 401k plan anyway. We'll talk more about that today too. But for right now, if you're getting a dollar for dollar match and you're doubling your money in a tax deferred account and you should be in a Roth IRA, if I have to explain why you should be in a Roth IRA, it's almost inevitable that you should be in a Roth IRA. Or a 401k. There's very few situations where a conventional makes sense. And unless you know exactly why you're doing it, you're wrong. I promise you. But if you have that money where you'll be able to sell it one day, whatever securities are in there, withdraw from it, never pay tax on it, and you're doubling it the day it goes in, I would tend to stick with that and have a long-term Bitcoin plan to go with it. You'll be able to buy, you know, IBIT or something like that. And I would say almost every 401k is going to have a Bitcoin option unless the employer is just obstinate about it and is holding their breath and doesn't want to do it within 2 years. Because BlackRock et al. Are doing all they can to pressure every HR Karen to, hey, you need this in there now, right? If it's a 6%, as in I put in $100, they put in six, it's chump change. And I would seriously think about just redirecting to a Bitcoin stacking plan. But I would also say, like, so this is your retirement we're talking about here. You should be saving money inside and outside of retirement vehicles. Remember, 401k is not an asset. It's a vehicle that holds assets. It's a form of account is all that it is. And so if you're going to take that money and you're not saving for your retirement in some form of tax deferral, you probably would then want to set up a Bitcoin IRA or just an IRA and hold mutual ETFs in it for your Bitcoin. And you should look at that and see based on the total dollars in, how it all works, fees, everything else involved, because the one thing the ETFs have going for them, they're extremely low fees. It's like 0.25%, which beats any exchange's fees out there. Now, I know people say, it's not real Bitcoin. So you don't know how an ETF works, and I'm not here to tell you today. I already did that in the past. You need to go look that up. That's not how ETF. You can't have an ETF with a commodity that's on a public blockchain where we already know, like, I'll bring it up for you guys right now on screen, those of you that are here. We already have this pretty cool data management tool that shows the inflows of Bitcoin ETFs. Let me get that up on the screen for you right now. But the other thing you'll find if you go there is we already know the addresses. Some have been publicly disclosed by the companies, but when you're moving this much money and we can look at basic chain analysis and we know that this much money moved this day and then there on the blockchain it sits this address with that exact amount in it, it's pretty easy to figure out what the addresses of BlackRock, what the Fidelity, VanEck, all of them are, Grayscale. We know what they are. And if you dig into this table, and I will put a link in the show notes, I'll add it if I don't forget anyway, where you can look this up and look at that inflow. Isn't that healthy? A healthy amount. Look, if you go back to when it was nothing but Grayscale, that's ETF day when it launched. And you look at the other side of that graph, that's how much net inflow there's been. And then everything else represents how much Grayscale has lost and bled off to other ETF providers. But we know. So they have the Bitcoin. It's one of the most heavy regulated spaces out there. I get that you can't trust government, you can't trust companies, but you know that money's there. And so inside an IRA, it might make sense. All I'm saying is if you're going to cut off your contributions to your 401k at work and you're not investing somewhere else in something that's designated as retirement money, there's a big temptation to piss away money as it builds up. And so maybe you even split the difference and say, I'm going to put 80% of the Bitcoin that I buy into this retirement style account and 20% outside of it so that it's accessible if I need it in an emergency. That's another strategy as well. But it's up to you how you want to do it. And you can do IRAs with full self-custody, and you can do IRAs with multi-sig, which means you technically have full custody, but you also have that backup of that third key. The way multi-sig works is it's a two of three. So it's like launching a missile, two guys that can't reach both of them at the same time. They have to be turned at the same time. And so two people have to both agree we're really going to do this. That's kind of how multi-sig works. You have two separate seed phrases, and you need both of them. But you also have two that are yours and one that the custodian has. And if you lose one of your two, then as long as you have one, you can still move the Bitcoin. But if something blows up crazy, you still have full control. You might have consequences from a tax standpoint, but you still always have access to your money. But I would just be careful in not having money truly allocated for retirement in some way. Next was, what exactly does consolidate UTXOs mean? It means put your Bitcoin on single addresses, or let's say you had $100,000 worth of Bitcoin, all your addresses are holding $5,000 or more. It just means don't have an address that has $33 worth of Bitcoin on it. Because the more UTXOs you have to pull from, let's say you have a bunch of addresses, and many of us do, because for a long time we did the exact opposite of this. For privacy's sake, we would take every transaction to a new address. And when fees were really low a couple of years ago, I consolidated a lot of my stuff into, siloed UTXOs. All a UTXO is, this is not exactly an accurate answer, but it's good enough. It's an address. And so you want larger holdings per address. And I would say, like, people right now are saying minimum 500. I would build them to about $1,000 in value. And I see that as being very future-proof for you. And that's all that means. And the reason they say do it when fees are low and watch the blockchain is it costs less to do it. So when you have that opportunity, that's when to consolidate. If you're running a Lightning node, that's when to like put some money in and open more channels and things like that. That's all that really means. Next was, what is a 401k brokerage window? Okay. And I've had people tell me about these and ask about them both. And I haven't been in the space of employee-employer relationships in a very long time. So all of my money is managed either in direct brokerage where I have access to it, as in it's not in a retirement account or it's in some form of IRA or annuity. I have some annuities invested in as well. So I had to look into this myself because I'm not familiar with them because they're relatively new. Again, I haven't worked in an office environment like that for 13 years. So 14 years now. 14 and a half years. Holy shit. So it's something new to me, but it basically means that you can basically buy any security or certain securities, ETFs, et cetera, inside your 401k while you're still working. So usually your 401k you get, and there's 8, 10, 12 options, right? There'll be a bond fund. There'll be some sort of money market-like fund. There'll be a bond fund for like just basic U.S. debt, dollar government bond fund. There'll be a small cap, a mid cap, a large cap, a growth in income, a foreign market, something like that. And it'll be whatever the company that manages your 401k most wants to sell. That's what's going to be in there with the ability to diversify. A new feature that's been added for quite a while now actually is called the brokerage window. And that just means you can manage some of your 401k for yourself and buy anything you want, within certain limitations, like that has to be a publicly, you know, offered security. You're probably not going to be able in that brokerage window to buy stuff that trades like over the counter, big board, really high risk shit. You might even be able to do options trading or something with some of them. But in general, as I've looked at them, most of them are somewhat restrictive. There's also some other things to be aware of. And one is that it usually doesn't mean that you can do it with all your money. So if you have $10,000 in there, a lot of the brokerage window accounts have a 50% availability. So 50% will have to be in the choices they gave you, and 50% can go somewhere else. That's good. And that means you can buy IBIT or you can buy, you know, Fidelity or VanEck ETF. So that's why this came up when the ETF came out. I had no questions about this or nobody telling me about it either until the Bitcoin ETFs. The other thing to understand, though, is it's effectively like opening a brokerage account, and then that brokerage account is inside your 401k. So the beauty of a 401k for like a young person on their first job is they can literally say, put 2% of my salary in, divide it between these five funds, and it'll happen. Well, if you go to, you know, try to buy $5 worth of, you know, Franklin Templeton's, you know, emerging markets ETF directly for Franklin Templeton, they'll tell you to go screw. Like, that's not it. There's minimum investments. And if you want some brokerages too, will say like to open an account, you need to deposit $2,000 or $5,000. So in some of these instances, you have to have a balance high enough that the amount they'll let you move into the window is high enough to meet a minimum. That's another thing to look out for. And then the other thing is you'll have additional trading fees inside that brokerage window. But that's what it is, and it works really well if you have one. And right now, if I was employed and I had a 401 and it had a brokerage window, I would have pumped as much money into whatever Bitcoin ETFs I could buy through it as quickly as possible. If you're going to ask me which Bitcoin ETF to buy, I don't care, except I would buy the one with the lowest fees because they're all basically the same thing. They're all the same thing. And when people start saying, don't sell your Bitcoin to BlackRock or whatever, stop your stupid shit. There's not a single person in this space telling people who have free and clear stacked cold storage Bitcoin to turn it into an ETF. That is an argument that you have created for yourself to argue against. It doesn't exist. No one's saying to do that. And no one's telling a person that it's free and clear cash that's going to buy $5,000 worth of Bitcoin tomorrow with it, that's not going to be in an IRA or something like that, to buy an ETF. That's another argument that they invented because these influencers need something to talk about. It doesn't exist. Stop saying it. It makes you look stupid, right? And you know it makes you guys that are out there doing it. I know some of you listen to me. You know you look stupid, but you're doing it anyway because you run out of shit to talk about. Don't do it. Just don't do it. There's plenty of things to help people with without creating this fictitious world like where you're the savior that's going to prevent them from making a mistake. Not the way that it works. How do I choose between an IRA and cold storage? Well, there's actually, you can do cold storage in an IRA. So you don't have to. There, you know, there's retirement plans with companies like Swan where, like I said, it's multi-sig, but it's also cold storage. Those usually have a little bit higher fees, but you still basically have the hardware wallet, but they have visibility into the account. So they can report that, you know, Stymie took his Bitcoin out and he owes you money because he owes, you know, interest, penalties, taxes, or at least he needs to file paperwork to prove he doesn't owe you money. Because if you have a Roth IRA, remember, you can always withdraw the contributions without taxes and penalties as long as you do the paperwork right. And anybody tells you they you can't, this is what I want you to do with their financial investing advice. Wad it up in a little ball, hand it back to them, and tell them to shove it right up their ass. They don't know what they're talking about. You should not talk to people who give advice on things they don't know about. Just run away from those. There is some level of limitation to that, but it's pretty limited, as in when you initially contribute, like a certain time limit. I think it's 6 months or something like that. But for people that are, you don't have that much money in an account like that right away. So, and I think even that is still like mythology. I think pretty much you already paid tax on money you put into a Roth IRA. You already paid the income tax. The only thing you're tax sheltering inside a Roth IRA, 401k, et cetera, is the earnings. So the underlying contribution has already had the tax paid on it, and it's just a matter of filling out the form right. That's it. Fill out the form wrong, the form will tell you you owe money. And then the government will believe you and say, give us the money, please. So you don't really have to, but I'm going to take this question differently. Because I think what they really meant was, should I self-custody and my Bitcoin is my business other than what can be deferred from the blockchain, and I don't have it in an IRA, or should I put it in an IRA? Regardless of whether it's custodian held, multi-sig held, doesn't matter. I think that's the real question based on the way this question was worded. And I would say maybe split the difference in this day and age. 10 years ago, I would have said just self-custody, screw them. Here's the thing. You have complete and total control over your Bitcoin. But if you're going to use it at some point, it isn't a privacy coin, right? I'll acknowledge that. And if you are smart, you're probably going to pay capital gains on it when you sell it or effectively sell it by spending it. And so having some in a complete tax-deferred status is probably the money that you would use first in your retirement, just like you would if you had a whole bunch of stocks and mutual funds and whatever, ETFs, and like so a lot of it was in like a retirement account, and a lot of it was held outside a retirement account. Well, every time I trade the stuff outside the retirement account, I got to pay the government. And when I trade the stuff inside the retirement account, I don't. I can take a certain amount of distributions per year, and there's actually, now the other side of it, there's a point where they say, you got to take the money. You got to get it out of here. You got to take it. Okay, fine. I still have to pay tax on it. So it's how public do you want to be, right? Because I hate physical metal IRAs, right? I have my silver in an IRA, and it's physical metal in a safe in my house or whatever. Okay, well, that's stupid. You just took the most anonymous money known to man, and you made it the most public money known to man. Don't do that. But if you want to hold silver in an IRA, what do I tell you to do? Buy SLV. It's rapid, easy to exchange. There's no spot spreads, none of that. You just have price in, price out. That's the way to do that. So I think that's something you have to make as a personal decision for yourself. And for me to even try to advise that, I would need to know, what's your retirement plan look like? How much money do you have saved for retirement? How old are you? What's your income? Do you own your home? And when I say own, I mean like, is your mortgage paid off or is it so low that it's meaningless? Like, there's a lot of questions in answering how much money gets allocated into true retirement from this point forward. That's something you have to make your own decision on. The next one was, how would a loan against Bitcoin be paid back? Now, this wasn't my thing earlier that we came up with, where we were talking about how if I borrowed Bitcoin and had to pay back Bitcoin plus interest, that would be a very difficult loan to repay. And it would. They're asking right now, I go to some crypto exchange that does Bitcoin loans. and I borrow against Bitcoin, physically, what does the repayment look? It gets paid back in dollars. That's how it works. I have $100,000 worth of Bitcoin. I want a loan for $5,000. I'm going to collateralize at least $5,000 worth of Bitcoin, which means it's locked in a vault where it can be turned over to the debtor if I can't pay the bill. And if Bitcoin drops in price enough, I might have to move more units, more Satoshis over there to collateralize the loan, depending on how much of it I'd pay back. But I'm paid in dollars, usually stable coins or something like that, if I need money on the outside of the crypto universe, because a lot of this is done as trading, basically trading on margin is what's going on with a lot of these loans. That's why they're short-term high interest. They're not great loans. But you're given dollars and you repay in dollars. And that prevents you from, again, owing a quarter of a Bitcoin. And now that quarter of a Bitcoin is five times more valuable than when you borrowed it. Because there's a usurious interest rate there, right? Even though the interest rate could be zero. But again, even in that scenario where you lose, if I'm the lender, what's my incentive? Well, it went up in value. By the time you got it back, it was worth more. Yeah, but if I would have just kept it, I would have had no risk. So that's how that works. And that's why if we do get into this sailor scenario of retirement where we're collateralizing 3 or 4% for cash flow, and then we're running that cycle over years of our retirement to have tax-free cash flow and zero income, we have to have a depreciating currency against an appreciating asset of property, which is what we have right now. And again, let's say that wasn't the case. Let's say that we enter a scenario where Bitcoin does become the standard, or we're on a hard money standard. We have a lot of things to figure out, but borrowing money against money doesn't work in that scenario. It just doesn't. I don't think you need to worry about that. I do not think you need to worry about. And there's some squawk about this, I think, going on right now. There was a lot of questions about it in the Telegram channel before I started. What should you do about high fees when you're buying Bitcoin and taking custody? So right now, the best place you can buy Bitcoin if you're worried about fees is Swan. I don't know how long this is going to last, but right now Swan's doing, if you already have an account, your next $10,000 in trades are free, no fees. And if you open an account, your first $10,000 in purchases of Bitcoin are no fee. So you can't get less than zero. I guess you could get paid to do it, but that's probably not going to happen. Swan is great. Strike is cheap. I bought, just to test what it was, I bought $200 worth of Bitcoin with Strike today. It was $1.96. So that's just a hair shy of 1%. So the way you handle the fees as far as the purchase fees, because like Coinbase is high as shit now on their fees. The only reason I still even recommend Coinbase at all is it is literally the easiest one to use. It looks like PayPal. And so a person that can use PayPal will have no trouble using it. I almost don't want to recommend it anymore at all, though, because now when my recommendation with them at all goes back so long that there was a time when they were the only really easy one to use that was also, pretty safe and trustworthy. But the problem with Coinbase to me now is they are a shitcoin casino. And when you set up accounts, they like push the shit out of shitcoins at you. And you need to understand why these exchanges become shitcoin casinos and why they push all these shitcoins at you. Well, they do it because they want to make money. And you can make money as a Bitcoin-only exchange, but you don't make a lot unless you really have a huge customer base, because your customer buys Bitcoin, they pay a small fee, they withdraw it, and they don't ever pay you again. But if you can keep them rolling their money back and forth, you don't care if they win, lose, or draw, because every time the money moves, you make money. That's it. Exchanges are in the business of exchange. So the more exchanging, the more profit. That's why they do that. So I don't really like Coinbase at all anymore based on how expensive they are and that their new people are very – even when they say, I'm going to do what Jack said. I'm going to be Bitcoin only. And then they're like, oh, shitcoin XYZ, it's cheap. wow, look, I saw a YouTube video that says Microsoft is going to integrate it in games or something. I'll buy some of that, and all of a sudden they start bleeding out. So Swan and Strike are two of my favorites. Strike I really like for low purchases, you know, under a grand a month. The beauty of Coinbase still, and somebody let me know if there's another exchange, especially a better one where this is true, you can link a PayPal account to Coinbase, and you can pay for your Bitcoin with PayPal. You can also buy Bitcoin in PayPal, and my understanding is you can take custody of Bitcoin out of PayPal, but I don't know that because my PayPal account's a business account, and if you have a business PayPal account, you can't buy Bitcoin in it. But there are other ways. There's, you know, I think you can buy Bitcoin in, you know, Zelle or whatever the other one is. Venmo, I think you can buy Bitcoin in now. Like, there's a lot of places you can buy Bitcoin. I don't want to buy Bitcoin from anybody that I can't take custody of. If I'm in that world, it's only because we're in a retirement account scenario where the money's not available for Bitcoin. If I'm buying it with my money that's free and clear, I want to be able to take custody. So that's one level of fees. But the other fee is withdrawal fees. And this is where you have to take advice and understand it in its context. So I say, do not hold your Bitcoin on the exchange. Well, I bought $50 today, Jack said, not that sold on exchange. I better withdraw it. No, 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 no. I don't give a rat's ass about your $50. Right? I don't care. It doesn't matter. It's not important. Your life, if it's lost, your life will not change. My rule when I'm buying Bitcoin on an exchange is I will accrue at least $500 before I'll withdraw. And withdrawal is not a function of amount. It's a function of transaction, which means it can cost as much to transfer $1,000 as it can sometimes to transfer $200. So the higher the dollar value of the transaction, the percentile fee that you pay is going to be lower. And then the other thing you do is you watch transaction fees. And when they're at a low point and you have a sizable balance, that's when you move the money off. So your big stack, your continuously growing stack is self-custodied and you're accruing small amounts. Just like I don't worry about Lightning, right? Like, oh, Lightning. You got, it's at risk. You could get rugged, whatever. I'm going to just pull up. I'm in my my wallet that I have in Primal, which is a Nostr client. I have $219 in that Lightning wallet. And I'm not worried about it. Like, if something blew up and I lost that $219, I would be pissed. But within a couple of weeks, I wouldn't even remember it happened unless somebody asked me about it. And that's how I feel about a couple hundred dollars on an exchange. And then the odds that, like, the $200 in Primal and the $200 sitting in Swan or whatever would all blow up on the same day, like, it's not very high. Like, they're different. Like, Swan is going to be on-chain. They're direct holding. They're fully, you know, one for one. This is in a Lightning node that's actually, I think, the back end of the Primal Lightning wallet is run by Strike. So it's effectively like holding money in Strike. I'm not worried about it. Just move it when it accrues to a point where it financially makes sense and find an exchange with low fees to buy from. And if you're really comfortable with an exchange that's gouging you, get out of your comfort zone. Go find another exchange. I'm sorry. You just sometimes you have to change. Ledger, I don't know who's saying it went open source, but Ledger I would stay away from because of some of their business practices. They used to be a recommended vendor by me. I do not recommend them anymore. I like Trezor is a great starting hardware wallet. Cold cards are great. There's a lot of options out there. Stay away from Ledger. Just stay the fuck away from Ledger. I'm sorry. So that's all I've got. Now, I've got some questions from you guys, but I want to end with something before I take your questions. And that is, there's a lot of time to get involved with Bitcoin. We are still early. If you look at the global adoption curve, we're very, very early. And there's all good signals going forward. You have the likely next president, again, the Trumpkin, the great Trumpkin, looks like he's going to rise again in November, pledging to protect your right to crypto. That's the word he's using. All I'm saying is I don't think he's going to mess with it. I don't think Biden is either, even though they rattle around about it. You don't have your FTC approve an ETF for Bitcoin and then turn around and ban it. You just don't. So a lot of this, I think there might be some more regs coming and stuff, especially around crypto, because they like to regulate everything. But it's not going anywhere. It's not going anywhere at all. But it is going up. And in the words of Michael Saylor and Odell and many others, it's going up forever. It's never going down in reality. This up, down, that continuously moves in an upward trend is not going down. It's volatility on an upward trend, a continuous upward trend. And Bitcoin has gone one real direction over time since it launched, and that is up. That is it. It doesn't mean you can't go buy it at the height of the market because you FOMO'd in and end up miserable for a couple of years while you wait for that cycle to repeat. You certainly can. This is why I like DCA, which is dollar cost average. You just keep buying in over time, and people have shown over and over and over and over and over. I'm looking here. I'm going to keep an eye on this shit here with Charlie Cooper. I'm just hoping that's fun talk. But if you're actually insulting somebody in my chat, I will throw you the fuck out. So we'll see. I don't want to come down on you because maybe you guys are just playing with each other. But I'm gonna keep an eye on that chat. Let's go ahead. But my whole point with this is you get the price you deserve. Everybody gets the Bitcoin price they deserve. The longer you wait, the higher it goes over time, the more you're going to suffer long term for not having it. Okay? And I know what somebody's going to say, but Jack, it's really high right now. I'm going to wait for the price to go down. But you didn't. You're probably the person that told me that. You're probably the person that told me some stupid shit when it was at like 66,000 a few years ago. And you said something stupid to me like, man, when it hits $30,000, that's where I'm backing up the truck, man. And you didn't do it. You don't even have a truck. You don't have enough reserve capital. All these people that say shit like that, they never have any money. But what you do have is a little bit of money. You have a little bit of money. And you could be putting a little bit of money at a time in over time and accumulate. And in all the years you spent arguing with people like me about it's going to go to zero, you're trusting your money to a light switch, government going to ban it, all you did was make yourself poorer for not having taken the initiative to make small contributions over time. And it's not too late. But you will not get as far as you would have if you started last year. And last year, if you started, you wouldn't have gotten as far as if you had started, let's say, in 2017. And the reality is a lot of you guys look at people like me and other people that talk in this space all the time, and you say, man, these people have been in for 10 years or more. They have to have huge stacks. A lot of us don't. I mean, we have good stacks, but we probably don't have what you think. Because back in the day when Bitcoin was $60, $600 and whatever, and we were making money in Bitcoin, we spent a lot of it. We spent it to help it get its start. Like, there was a whole movement of, like, live as much on Bitcoin as you can to get it. Like, we believed in it. We also, like, as much as we believed in it, we also thought, like, what's the point of money if we don't spend it? And a lot of us ended up making a good profit right away, and then you get into that, hey, it's the house's money mindset. Let's go ahead and spend it. And so if you did get in 10 years ago, the odds that you would have all you stacked are pretty low. If you got in 5 years ago, you may very well have just about every Satoshi you ever bought for stacking. You might have bought some for, you know, using on social media or for some spending or things like that. But every single Satoshi I didn't buy, I regret. Every single Satoshi I spent, I regret. Learn from my history so you don't have to do it for yourself. But if you do not get in sometime soon, then you're just hurting yourself. And, you know, the title of today's episode is Bitcoin is now a zero risk move. The only risk there really is not having any. That's the risk. That's the risk. Anyway, let's go ahead and take some of y'all's questions. I've only got like four. So if you don't see it come up, you can always go ahead. I'll give you, you know, one more time around the horn, so to say, here. Word question in all caps, and I will answer it. So Victory Garden said, to what degree do you understand the depth engineering of blockchain? I need to look into it more, but but I see people probably much smarter than me leaning in all the time, so it seems good. I don't know what you're really asking. The engineering of blockchain? What blockchain? Are you asking a general blockchain question? If you want to know exactly how the Bitcoin blockchain works, how mining works and hash rates work and all of that, then go to the BitcoinBreakout.com in the tag cloud, select the fundamental series, and start with episode one of the Bitcoin Breakout, and I explain everything. I even show you tools you can use to experience what hashing really looks like by hitting enter and you get a hash, and enter and you get a hash, and enter and get a hash, and watch blockchain change. I understand it fairly well. The truth is you don't need to understand it very well, though. You don't. I mean, unless you're going to build one, and I don't know why you would, but if you're going to build one, then you need to understand it. If you're going to get deeply into mining, maybe you want to understand it a little bit better. But this is what blockchains are. They're slow and they're contentious. That's what they are. They're supposed to be. It's a feature, not a bug. And so a lot of this, like there was this bullshit that went around 17 and 18, right? Blockchain, not Bitcoin. And if we're rehashing that, man, don't. There's like a company doesn't need a blockchain for internal accounting. That's a dumb thing. And if you get into a proof of stake network, just forget about it because it's another form of trust me. It's trust me instead of verify. So if you have a way you want to further explain that question as to what you're trying to accomplish, I can take another shot at it. But right now I'm only speculating because it's kind of clunky. Richard says, will we see more seizures like what happened in Germany? I don't know what happened in Germany. But the only way you can have your Bitcoin seized is for it to be on an exchange, which is why I tell you to get it off frickin' exchange. If you're talking about the bullshit about, you know, Hamas being funded, that was a lie, by the way. But you can't seize Bitcoin. You can seize accounts that have Bitcoin in them, but you can't seize Bitcoin. You have Bitcoin in your own custody. No one's seizing anything. So that's another one. If you want to explain further what you mean by that, I will try to answer it better for you. But every time you hear that Bitcoin was seized or crypto was seized, it was taken off an exchange account. I defy you. You know what? I have a lot of Bitcoin. Go ahead, take as much as you want. If you can get it, you can have it. I won't even cry about it. That's how I'll put that. Charlie says, is Satoshi a government experiment? Why would a mysterious Japanese programmer gift this to the world for free? Well, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to dispel the idea that he's Japanese. Hackers call themselves whatever the fuck they want to. They name themselves after superheroes. They name themselves after Roman gods. They, you know, it's just a name that the guy came up with. So there's no reason to believe the dude's even Asian, let alone Japanese, though he might be. There's just no way to know. When you say he did it for free, we don't know that either. We know the first addresses that Satoshi used to mine Bitcoin. And Satoshi's worth a fortune, billions, based on that. But we don't know that he wasn't also mining the other addresses and he doesn't have plenty of Bitcoin and he's living off it somewhere. We don't know that. We have no way of knowing that. And certainly if he ever decided he wanted to access that Bitcoin, he could. That's why we know Craig Wright is a fucking liar, because if Craig S. Wright was Satoshi, all he would have had to do is move one sat or sign one signature into one of those blocks, which he never did because he's not. This idea that Satoshi's a government plant. The government hated Bitcoin. See, I think when people get into this, what you're doing is you're inferring a level of competence in our government that they have never demonstrated that they had. What discipline would it have taken to do this and then pretend to be against it for over a decade before you kind of sort of reluctantly accepted it? What benefit is there to the government in Bitcoin? And let's take this another way. Let's say that that Satoshi really was a CIA spook. Now, we know there was an attempt by the CIA to set up a meeting with Satoshi. We know this from the Bitcoin Talk forums. And we know that right around the time that that happened, Satoshi vanished like a fart in the wind. And the theory, because he never said, I'm leaving because, but the theory is he kind of got spooked by the spooks. Somebody hauled ass. Let's say it's not true. let's say Satoshi was a team of coders at the CIA. See, they're going to get you. How? We already know the blockchain is public. We already know that if you buy from an exchange that did KYC and you send the money to yourself, that the government can say this address probably belongs to you. And if not, prove it doesn't. The burden of proof would be on you, even though that's not the way our system of justice is supposed to work. So what do they get out of that? We already know that. It's not like they hid that from us. It's not like Bitcoin is like Monero with a back door where you think it's private, but it isn't. And everybody that ever thought it was private or, you know, actually anonymous was wrong. No one ever claimed that it was. Satoshi and people that helped with the development early on, like Hal Finney, et cetera, on Bitcoin Talk, discussed making it fully private and decided against it because they didn't believe that it would be trusted or able to actually catch on in the world if they did so, and they were probably right. The only reason things like Monero and any other coin worked was because Bitcoin came first and became established. So what if Satoshi is a team of CIA programmers? Okay. The code is available for anybody to look at. People all over the world have looked at the code. If there was a backdoor or something by now, it would have been found. It would have been found. So it's a little like who created the internet as we know it today? Well, now Gore, but it was the government. Like the original internet was more like this point-to-point connection. It wasn't really an internet that we think of like that came on board in the 90s when the idiots over at Good Morning America were like, what is internet? What is email? I don't understand. What's that A thing in the email? What does that mean? It means at you, moron. Who benefits the most by the internet today, the people or the government? Genie can't go back in the bottle. Yeah, there's a lot of psyops and stuff. It's just a communications medium, though. But how many people run businesses today because of the internet? So even if Satoshi was a CIA spook or something, like an NSA spook, I don't know. First of all, I think we would know by now. As much as they are a clandestine group, they're not real good at keeping their secrets. There's been so many data dumps. I mean, you have to be ultra-level, high-security. Congress wouldn't be doing some of the crap they've pulled. Like, and then look at what it led to. This plethora of crypto, including privacy coins, including stable coins and all. Like, if it was, it's too late anyway. Now you've got decentralized mining all over the world. It's unstoppable. It wouldn't even matter, right? And all that would mean is their eventual plan is for it to actually be the currency of the world. And if that was the case, then all of Satoshi's Bitcoin is in the U.S. Treasury some sort of way by proxy. And eventually it will be a global monetary standard. And then you want as much of it as you can get. But I just don't think that's the case. It doesn't make sense to me in any way that Satoshi is the CIA or what have you. I think Satoshi is exactly what he looked like, an organic cypherpunk who wanted to do something really cool and took existing technologies like Merkle trees, et cetera, and put them together in a way they had never done before and created, for the first time in the world, absolute scarcity. 229 Mix says, how do you know or track when fees are low or transferring Bitcoin? There's literally sites you can look at Bitcoin fees over time, like search for Google for that. You can literally look at graphs that tell you where the fees are, where they were, where they're going. Like you can see at any given time what fees are. It's just not hard to even find out. I'm going to see if anybody else asked a question. There's been quite a bit of comments. Okay, here's a question. How do you explain the difference between Ethereum and Bitcoin to normies? They're not the same thing, and they should not be compared to each other at all. That's how I explain it. And you shouldn't buy Ethereum because Ethereum has one purpose, to be the mother asshole from which other shit coins are spawned. If you want a deeper explanation, especially since Ethereum made some changes, Ethereum is a proof of stake network, not a proof of work network, which means you are trusting people with your money instead of making people verify that they deserve your money. And if you want another explanation of how they're different, Bitcoin is 100% locked in of its inflation rate over time. We know exactly how much Bitcoin will be mined every day, month, and year from now until the last Bitcoin's mined, when we're all dead. We know that. 100%. No one can change that number. No one can change the issuance rate. No one can change the supply. Ethereum has changed its monetary policy multiple times, and it's changed its supply multiple times, and its issuance multiple times. So Ethereum is shit. That's how I explain the difference. One is shit, and one is hard money. I can even tell you, like, I can't say that about certain Bitcoin forks. I mean, some of the Bitcoin forks, and I'm not really talking about Bitcoin Trash or Satoshi Vision, but, like, Litecoin is a Bitcoin fork. It has more units. It's a faster transaction for less money, and it is hard-coded. Of course, it was a pre-mine. Yeah. It's not an immaculate conception like Bitcoin was. So, but there are some other cryptos out there. I see no purpose for us having them, but at least they're better coins, let's say, than something like Ethereum or any coin minted off of Ethereum, like an ERC-20 token or whatever. Like, I don't even pay attention to it anymore. It's garbage. It's garbage. But that's and what he's saying now is he knows all this, but he doesn't want to come off too strong or pushy to newbies. I think the best thing you can do with the person that's asking a question, and you don't have to sound as antagonistic as I just did there, but tell them the truth. One is hard money. The other is controlled by a foundation that can change the rules whenever they choose to. Ethereum, the Ethereum Foundation can and has locked addresses down because you don't have an Ethereum address, actually. You have an account. You go to a Bitcoin wallet, you can say, I want a new address, and it gives you a new address. And you go to an Ethereum wallet, and you get one number every time. So every Ethereum that you move over is in one place and can be seen. Yes, I said to consolidate your UTXOs, but I also said 500, 1,000, 2,000 bucks per UTXO. What if you're sitting on $500,000 worth of Ethereum and you accept Ethereum? Nobody really seems to actually accept Ethereum, but let's say you did, and you sell somebody something for 200 bucks and they send it to that Ethereum account number, not an address, that again, the Ethereum Foundation get a letter from the government and lock it where you can't move your money. Okay, and that has, it's not common, but it has happened. But let's take it a different way altogether. Since I'm locked into that one account number, and yes, I could have multiple wallets, but that's a pain in the ass, right? And builder of castles here, right? Builder of castles says, Jack, I want to buy a thingamabob off your website. You take Ethereum. And I say, sure, man. He sends me some Ethereum. And he goes, I wonder how much Ethereum's at that address I just sent that to. And he pulls it up and it says $500,000. You know, there is one way to break crypto encryption keys. It's very cheap. It's a $5 wrench method. That's where somebody hits you in the head with a wrench until you tell them how to get the money. Putting a target on your back and saying, I have in one place $500,000 that can be transferred. And once you have it, no really can really get it back from you. That's a way to maybe wake up with a gun in your mouth. And then you don't even have, like, people say, well, Jack, people know you have some crypto. And yeah, but you don't know how much. I don't tell you that. So even if I were to say, well, here's the seed phrase, they're going to get what they get, and it ain't all in one place because that's another security risk. But in this instance, they would be able to be like, right now, like, one guy's got a gun in your mouth, the other guy's on the screen going, I'm looking at Block Explorer here, dude. You have $516,000 worth of ETH. I want it. Hit him with the wrench in the arm again until he, you know, hit his elbow. Take that combination wrench and put it around his pinky and start bending that shit backwards until he talks. Right? You're just setting yourself up for all kinds of problems with Ethereum. And I even own a significant stack of it still. And it is on one place. And the reason I own it is because I got it so cheap. Because I bought it a long time ago. And it's something I've slowly, when I've wanted to make a purchase of something outside the crypto world, and I wanted some of my wealth that was held that way to get transferred into dollars, That's what I've sold, not Bitcoin, since I've learned my lesson. And people would say, why not just sell it all and buy Bitcoin? Because I would take a huge capital gains hit on it all in one go if I did that. That's why. And it ain't never going back below where I bought it. I can tell you that, unless it completely blows up. I'm gonna humor this because I know it's a joke. Dogecoin resurgence when? Never. Never. See, Doge is worse than the US dollar for inflation. It can be played around with, it can be manipulated, it can go up a penny or so here or there. And the same group that did the GameStop bullshit did it with Dogecoin at one time. I even made a bunch of money playing with it back in my shitcoiner days. I even did screenshots on the Telegram channel. I think I took like $600 worth of Bitcoin that I had in Coinbase, and I threw it on a shitcoin, a real shitcoin exchange, but one that was much better than Coinbase for doing this. And I think I changed $600 worth of Bitcoin into like $3,500 worth of Bitcoin over like 2 week period. And then I'm like, I'm done. I'm out. And I was just playing with Doge going up and down. And I don't do that anymore. And even if I did, I wouldn't publicly show people me doing it because everybody sees it and they think you're a hero when you get it right. But you don't always get it right. You just don't always. I knew at that point in time. In fact, I was like, oh, they're doing this. Okay, then I'll play this game. Right? Because I knew somebody else was gaming it. And that's why I did it. But it could have just as easily blown up in my face. And the problem is when people do this for their first time and they get it right, they trick themselves into thinking that they're smarter than they are. They think they were able to do it because they're a genius. They just didn't know they were a genius. And now they do. And then they really get, all right, accidentally ticked the mute mic button. Anyway, I do want to wrap up. Wanted to remind you guys, as always, if you want to help this show and the work that I do, you can always help us out by doing your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Item of the day today is the same one I ran most of last week, and instead of bringing it up on the screen, I'm going to show it to you. It's this guy right here. This is my bamboo cutting board, end grain bamboo cutting board, end grain being very, very, very important. Because when you have end grain for a board, and I wanted you to just kind of see, this thing is beefy. The bottom has these little feet on it, so you don't ever actually cut on this surface. You always cut on this surface. I bought this in the spring of 2018, and it's still in perfect shape. There's not a single place where any of the pieces of bamboo have begun to separate or anything like that. Like I said, all I do is wash it whenever we use it, and about once a month put mineral oil on it. That's the only thing I do, and that's all that's necessary for that thing to last forever. They're still on sale for the mid, like $43 or something, and they're normally like $70. They are absolutely fantastic. And I want you to understand something about end grain boards. It's not just they perform better, they also dull knives less. So if you take your hands and you put them together like you're praying, and you look down at the tips of your fingers, that's what the end grain of the wood kind of would look like under magnification. And what that means, and that's part of why they perform better, is when you draw the knife across it, they find their way into those areas, like the bristles of a dartboard. Like a dart actually doesn't penetrate the board, it separates the bristles. And so that happens. But the other thing that happens is that means it's easier on the blade of the knife. So the knife stays sharper longer. Bamboo is incredibly hard. People don't think it is because it's a grass, but it's very, very hard. It's harder than many, many woods, honestly. And so when you have the cheap bamboo boards that are cross-grain, those things are murder on knives. I mean, it's almost like dragging your knife across the freaking countertop. I mean, like a granite one or something is hard. Not an abrasive, but like a smooth granite. Like, it just wears blades out. These things, that knife continues to perform well for longer before it needs sharpening. The other thing I want to remind you about today is our principle-based permaculture design course. And you can take that course for the whopping price of $0. That's right. It costs nothing to take our principle-based permaculture design course. You'll find that over at homefoodsystems.com. Homefoodsystems.com. There is a link down in the video notes if you're watching the video. And you can, you know, you set up an account with us. And this course, you just say you want to take it and you go ahead and take it. Kind of want to show you how our courses are. So when you log into your account, you'll see a description of all the chapters. Down at the bottom, you'll see the content. When you click on the content, you'll go into the individual lessons, and each lesson has a video or group of videos. You can start them, play them, watch them. It's basically me going through a presentation that uses PowerPoint. We go through all of those. At the end of that lesson, you're able to then take your quiz. So here you would drill into this and you start your quiz and you start answering your questions. Most of them are multiple choice. Some are true, false. There's a few other options there, but that's how most of them are. At the end of your quiz, you know how well you did or didn't do. You can retake the quiz. The quizzes are part of learning. When you're done, you actually get a certificate you can print out or save as a soft file and add it to any sort of CV that you have. If you do like permaculture consulting or regenerative consulting or something like that, or if you just want it. We also have a plugin that Tom installed that does notes. So you can see right here, you can take notes as you're watching it. And if you've taken notes, all your notes will be saved for you. And if you want to ask me a question, you use the same plugin. You click Notify Instructor, ask your question. I answer all the questions people have in these courses, usually within 24 hours, as long as you click the Notify Instructor thing. If you don't do that, I won't know that you asked, and I don't go in and check all of everybody's notes. I don't. It's not my business. So please only check Notify Instructor if I am actually needing to be notified if you take the course. But that's free. And let me tell you why you should take the Permaculture Principles course beyond the fact that it's free. It's principle-based design. Principles are agnostic to everything. They don't care what your climate is. They don't care, you know, what your seasonal climate's like. They don't care what your terrain features are like. They don't care how big your yard is. They don't care if you're in the tropics or in New England. Principles are principles, and they apply everywhere. They apply equally. And when you do principle-based design, you become adaptive in your design capability. I go through David Holmgren's 12 principles. I go through Bill Mollison's ethics, and I explain how all that works, and I give a lot of design examples. It's about a 4.5-hour course, and it is 100% free. It gives you the opportunity to come to Home Food Systems, see what a course there is really like, and decide whether it's for you before you spend money on our course. I'm hoping to get the rest of the cover crop course done this month, and Tom will probably need like another week or so to get it ready for sale by the time I'm done with it. He pretty much is doing it as I'm producing the content. He's adding it to the site. We're over halfway done with that part of putting those courses together. Again, that course took me about 2 months before I was ready to even start doing the presentations. I put a lot of work into these. I really believe that in order for me to do these courses, most of them have to have a fee or I can't put the time in, but I try to keep that fee low enough that anybody that really wants to learn can. The bioreactor compost course is $40. It's $35 for MSB members. I had a lot of work into that one too, and I am trying to build something that will outlive me, leave that legacy of knowledge behind when I'm gone, that will help people build better lives. That's what Home Food Systems is all about, and I invite you to learn more about it today. Again, homefoodsystems.com. Consider the bioreactor course too. Even though that one costs money, everybody that's taken it has had positive things to say about it. With that, guys, I'll catch you tomorrow. And tomorrow I will catch you 09:30 Central Daylight Time with two of my favorite people, John Willis from SOE Tactical Gear and Nicole Sauce from HollerRoast.com and NicoleSauce.com, because it is the first Tuesday. No, it is not the first Tuesday. What am I thinking? Where did I get that from? I don't know. So tomorrow we'll just have another show. I don't know. I jumped ahead a week. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow. Are they going to bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.